is from this faculty, where I taught for about 20 years. We have a particularly distinguished panel today, I am supposed to say, for the record. This is session 1505. The Constitution, we love you, you're perfect, now change. I guess that tells the panel what to do. We're going to hear from each of them briefly. Then they will talk among themselves a bit. And we'll be taking questions from the audience in either two forms. If you have the app and you send a question to it, it should show up in front of me. And I'll edit them to find ones that are repeated, which I want to ask the panelists, or particularly interesting ones. And our final part of the session then will be simply the questions that come in from the audience to the panelists. So feel free to direct a question either to the panel generally or to a member of it. Three of the four panelists are in your program, so I won't say really anything about them except to let you know which is which. The one who joined after the conference went to press is Robert Nagel off to my right, known to many of you, my former colleague and Ira Rothkerber Chair Emeritus from this faculty, teaching and writing constitutional law here for many years. The others are Bob's right, John Eastman, Salvatore Professor of Law at Chapman, described further in the program. My left, Ian Millheiser, columnist for Think Progress. I think we're all in favor of that. And Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented and president of True North Research. The way we will proceed is we'll simply alternate here, and each panelist will take about 5 minutes to give you the essence. That's an academic 5 minutes, all right? To give you the essence of
your idea. We're talking about, we can't see him at all.
Just put him on the shelf below.
Remove it? Okay.
I often tell people to speak into the microphone, but never tell them to speak into the name tag. Okay. Let's start, and that means, Ian, you're up.
All right. So I want to start by taking stock of the government that we have right now. So the president wasn't elected. He lost the popular vote by 3 million, almost 3 million votes. We have a Senate where the 53-senator majority represent 15 million fewer, or 15 million fewer people than the 47-senator minority. And we have a Supreme Court that has two of the most illegitimate members in American history. And I want to explain specifically what I mean by that. The first member of the Supreme Court in American history who was nominated by an unelected president and confirmed by a block of senators that represents less than half of the nation is Neil Gorsuch. The second person in American history to have that dubious honor is Brett Kavanaugh. So the balance of power on the Supreme Court is held by two judges who have less democratic legitimacy than anyone who has ever sat on the Supreme Court of the United States. And all this, of course, has to be understood in the context of Merrick Garland. So unlike Donald Trump, Barack Obama won an election. He won two of them. And at the time when he nominated Merrick Garland, the Democratic minority represented 20 million more people. The minority in the Senate represented 20 million more people than the majority that refused to even give Judge Garland a hearing. And so we have a system of government that's not delivering results that bear any resemblance whatsoever to the will of the American people. And it's been like this for a while. If you're 30 years old, in your entire lifetime, there's been one election where the Republican Party won the popular vote in the presidential race, and yet they dominate government. I'm 41 years old. Since I became eligible to vote, there has been exactly one election where the Republican Party, actually won the presidency. And it's going to get a lot worse. So there's a UVA study that looks at census projections into 2040. And they found that by 2040, 50% of the country is going to live in 8 states. So that means half the country gets 16 senators, the other half of the country gets 84 senators. 70% of the country is going to live in 16 states. And with, and the other trend that, of course, we're seeing in our democracy is that Democrats tend to cluster into more into population centers, and Republicans tend to be in more partially populated areas. So if we can see, if these demographic trends continue, that's going to mean that the Republican Party is going to have a permanent Senate supermajority, large enough to remove the President of the United States. And it won't matter how the voters vote, because the majority of the Senate will be determined by malapportionment. And when they get that permanent Senate supermajority, they also get permanent control of the judiciary. Because you can't confirm a judge unless you control the Senate. So we are in a situation where our Constitution is failing us. Our Constitution is not producing governance that in any way resemble the will of the people. And we can't fix it by a constitutional amendment. First of all, because in order to ratify a constitutional amendment, you need 3/4 of the states to sign on, and the ones that benefit from these pathologies I just described aren't going to do it. And second of all, there's actually a provision in Article 5 of the Constitution saying that you can't get rid of Senate malapportionment, so you would need 2 constitutional amendments. You would need 1 to remove that provision, and then a second one to actually amend the Constitution to get rid of, or at least have the Senate have some kind of proportional representation. What you can do, however, and if Democrats do not do this, they are going to be, again, locking themselves out of power permanently, is you can't admit new states. And I'll just say on this point that admitting D.C. and Puerto Rico is not going to be enough. You know, even assume that Puerto Rico would produce 2 Democratic senators, which is not for certain, that's still not going to overcome the massive advantage that malapportionment gives to the Republican Party. You have to start talking about things like splitting up California and New York into multiple states to achieve any kind of electoral parity in the Senate. So things are grim. And you should think that they are grim, even if you are a Republican. And the reason for that is because the entire premise of our country is that the right to govern flows from the will of the people. And that's not just like an airy idea. That's a good way to avoid civil unrest. You know, if people start to feel like they do not have recourse to elections, very bad things happen in countries that go in that direction. And so I hope that we can find a way to fix it. But if we don't start thinking about large-scale structural reforms that change the nature of how we choose our leaders, and you know that ensures that there's some sort of parity so that a voter in California has exactly as many votes as a voter in Wyoming, then the path that we were heading towards is going to be ruled by permanently installed oligarchs, and I would hope that we would not want.
Thank you, Ian. Before I turn to Bob Nagel, I'd like to ask a couple of others to come get the damn laptop and connect it so that I can get questions from you. Any of our CWA helpers know how to run a laptop? It was said to be easy, but that's true of technology. Now, Bob Nagel, after that interruption.
Well, the title of this program suggests the paradox that we love the Constitution, yet we want to change it for the purpose of bridging what it calls the equity gap. The question that I want to raise is whether closing the equity gap is in fact compatible with admiration for the Constitution. 2 of the major progressive proposals for amending the Constitution that are out there now are, 1, abolishing the Electoral College, which you've just heard something about, and 2, overturning Citizens United and Buckley against Bolea. Both of these proposals are striking illustrations of a desire to bridge the equity gap, and seem to many to be highly desirable adjustments to our system. The Electoral College, of course, means that each vote in less populated states would count for more than each vote in highly populated states. Similarly, overturning cases that implement the idea that money is a form of protected speech would further equality by permitting legislatures to regulate political contributions and expenditures so as to prevent real or perceived unfair inequalities in political influence. So these proposals and others like them probably seem benign, but are they fundamentally compatible with the Constitution that we supposedly love? Consider the implications of the principle of equality of political influence. Obviously, again, as you've just heard, the Senate is as incompatible with this principle as is the Electoral College, since each state gets two senators regardless of population. So equity would seem to require that we have one national legislative body, just as we should have a national popular vote for president. So far, so good, I guess many of you are thinking, but wait. Even a national legislature of this sort would involve massive amounts of unequal political influence. For one thing, representatives do not always vote as a majority of their constituents might want. For another, the unavoidable committee and leadership structures inevitably give more power to some representatives than to others. And some constituencies, those with political resources arising from, say, good educations, verbal and organizational skills, and so on, would continue to have more influence than others. So if we really believe in eliminating the equity gap, we have to consider abolishing even the national legislature. Equal influence would be better achieved by direct popular votes, maybe by computer or some other method, on all legislative issues. So you're probably thinking, well, he's entered the world of fantasy now. But what I'm suggesting is that abolishing the Electoral College and reversing cases like Citizens United involve a principle, call it bridging the equity gap if you want, that is incompatible with representative government itself. More fundamentally, the whole idea of a constitution gives more political power to those who draft the constitution than to living voters. Remember those dead white men who drafted the original one? Still have enormous influence, obviously, over our government. So closing the equity gap would require that we abandon representative government and constitutionalism itself. Love indeed.
Well, when I saw the title for this panel, I wasn't sure if I even agree with the fundamental premise of it. We love the Constitution, we love you now, change. I think there's a lot to love about our Constitution. I care for me at all times. But I think there are things that it clearly has gone wrong over time, and we've corrected those. As Ian points out, it's increasingly difficult to correct some of those flaws, given the changes in the way the United States population is basically situated, just geographically, just the geographic reality of a population distribution in this country. But I think that there are a couple things, and I don't intend this to be like a debate, on both sides in that sort of way, but I think that I would reject the premise that if you can't achieve perfect equality, there's no use in trying to achieve any effort to redress inequalities that exist. I think that there are substantial measures that we could take or we should be discussing as a democracy, as a people who aspire to have majority rule, but we do not, that we should be considering for how to make our union more perfect, how to have better representation, how to have more accountable representation of the people that we have entrusted to represent us. And I think those are worthy explorations. I would say a couple other things that I think are important to just begin this conversation from my perspective. One is that I think that there's another constitutional amendment effort that's underway. It's the balanced budget amendment effort. It's been underway for a long time, spearheaded in part by the billionaire Koch brothers. They've been after this since the 1970s. It's taken on a recent sort of momentum over the last couple of years, in which they have, according to their account, nearly 30 states willing to call an Article 5 convention in order to amend the Constitution to require a balanced budget that would absolutely destroy our economy. But more than that, in our research and examination of the groups that are pushing that balanced budget amendment, we see groups that were aspiring to include the coal industry and other enormous corporations in funding their effort to have a Constitutional Convention. The idea of that Constitutional Convention that we had back in Philadelphia more than 200 years ago, the idea that we would have a new one, but one which would be underwritten by corporations seeking to change our laws, is horrifying to me, quite frankly, notwithstanding the permission provided in Article 5 of the Constitution. But make no mistake, the people who want to make that convention happen are intending to advance an agenda that is pretty extreme and is one that they have no qualms about having dark money funders underwrite. I'd be wary. With regard to Citizens United, I think that that raises this second issue that I really want to bring to the fore for our conversation. And that's the question that goes in part to what Ian raised about the legitimacy or constitutional legitimacy or the legitimacy of some of the justices. But more than that, I think what Citizens United means is that we actually have a structural revolution that's already underway, that's being moved forward by five members of that Supreme Court that could be extended for 30 years if Justice Thomas were to retire, given the ages of the other four members of that majority. And I think when you look at their writings, when you look at the dissents, when you look at the opinions of some of these members, what it would be imprudent not to recognize that, in fact, their vision for our country, for our Constitution, is quite narrow, I would say regressive. If you look at Justice Thomas's opinions alone, you can see that he maps out a structure for our government in which we would not have the capacity to have some of the agencies that really have helped define America in the 20th century and that have really helped ensure that our country is, in fact, more aligned with the will of the people than the will of the robber barons or the industrialists of the golden, you know, the golden age of the robber baron age. I think you can see a movement, in essence. You hear about it sometimes from the groups on the left that there's an effort to roll back the clock before the New Deal. I think that that's underway, and I think Citizens United is part of that. When I read Citizens United, and I know we may have a debate about this, but I hope it's not the whole debate, I see a court that was willing to act with utter contempt for the power of Congress to regulate our elections, to have a reasonable set of rules under the McCain-Feingold Act, to require that there be disclosure, even though they said they weren't addressing disclosure. But the effect is that we have a surge in massive amounts of dark money coming in to influence our elections. We have no idea who really is behind that money. That's utterly distorting both the electoral process and the public policy process. And I would submit to you also the judicial nominations process. So while many people are debating what, you know, what's going to happen in 2020, what's happening with our country, what should we do about this electoral college issue, in fact, I think we have a majority on the court that is engaged in a sort of a set of revolutionary acts in their own right. I know that there's been the political discourse and aspiration by people who are backed by the Kochs to embrace the Koch idea of killing the Department of Energy, killing the Department of EPA, killing the Department of Education. They have a whole list of agencies they want to get rid of. When you look at Justice Thomas's opinions, you see an effort to basically move forward what is described as a non-delegation doctrine, an effort to discard what's been known for many years as Chevron deference in terms of the power of agencies to issue regulations that affect the people in this country. So I think we're going to see a substantial number of cases going forward with this five-person majority that is going to be putting forward a pretty radical, I would say, reactionary agenda without our consent, when you see what happened in the wake of the Industrial Revolution was a citizens' movement, people coming forward to say they wanted democracy to be responsive to them, they wanted to have the ability to regulate corporations. And what we've seen in the 70, 80, 90 years since then has been a persistent effort by corporations to shake off those regulations. And Citizens United and the dark money that's poured into the elections, dark money that that Mitch McConnell exalts in, are distorting and disrupting our democracy. The reason our democracy is not functioning properly in many ways is because of this influence of these very few rich billionaires who have an agenda that is not an agenda that serves the ideals of most people. Now, I know Professor Eastman comes after me, and he was a clerk for Justice Thomas, and so I'm sure you'll have plenty to say. But I would say, from my perspective, there is an essence of revolution underway by way of the judiciary, and I think we're on the verge of a judicial tyranny, and it's very worrisome.
As you might imagine, I have a different view about everything that was said. I'm teaching a class over at the main campus tomorrow on George Washington's farewell address, and so I've been reviewing that. And there's some wonderful things in there that I think we ought to call to mind about our Constitution. Federalism. We are authorized to hope, he says, that a proper organization of the whole over an extended territory, with the auxiliary agency of governments for the respective subdivisions, that's, you know, the reservation of power to the states, will prove our experiment in self-government a success. In fact, our Constitution is particularly well designed for it. And until amended by the explicit and authentic act of the people, it is sacredly obligatory on all. And he goes on, he says, the basics of our political system is the right of the people to make or alter the Constitution. That presupposes the duty of every individual to obey the established government, not to alter it by fiat. We have not had amendments to the Constitution that allow for the Department of Education, that allow for spending beyond the general welfare, that allow for regulation of the economy rather than a regulation of commerce among the states. And so there was a revolution in this country that dramatically altered the scope of our constitutional system and the power given to Washington, D.C. And that occurred in the 1930s in the New Deal. What we see now is the Supreme Court willing to enforce the Constitution as written. To call that a radical reactionary revolution is really preposterous. Washington goes on to say, don't allow changes to the constitutional structure, the structure which will impair the energy of the system and thus undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. Now, I noticed that both Ian and Lisa spoke of our democracy. The founders had a different view. They were as concerned about majority tyranny as they were about oligarchic tyranny or kingly tyranny that they had just thrown over. The structures of our Constitution, including the Electoral College, including the separate election of the Senate, those things were designed to refine the democracy so that the will of the majority, though ultimately would prevail, would be rightful, would be elevated to support the common good rather than a majority tyranny. Because a majority of 50% plus one that says we're going to take all of the 49% plus, you know, 0.9 of property of the other side, that does not secure the inalienable rights of the individual. Our Constitution is much more complex than a raw democracy and a plebiscite. And when you start messing with those structures, you end up with a couple of things like we're seeing now. $22 trillion in debt. Washington had something to say about that as well. He said one of the things in his farewell address, this is the father of our country kind of giving a message to his fellow citizens like a grandfather before he passes on. Preserve our public credit by avoiding debt. And when you incur debt necessarily to deal with the occasional things that arise, the emergencies that arise, the wars that arise, pay it off quickly so as not ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden which we ourselves ought to bear. Now, we made a couple of structural constitutional changes. Some by amendment. I think we got it wrong. The 17th Amendment that went to direct election of the senators got the states out of the business of the national government, and they had provided a confining check on runaway spending of the national government. Our runaway spending takes off after that, not before. But most of our other structural changes have occurred by fiat, either just by delegating power powers to the unelected branches of the executive. Washington had something to say about that as well, on separation of powers. Make sure that each branch scrupulously keeps itself consigned to its assigned constitutional spheres. None of our lawmaking goes on in the halls of Congress anymore, which is where we choose people to elect. It's very deep in the Constitution, I know. It's Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1. The legislative powers herein delegated are vested in a Congress of the United States. They're not vested in the EPA or the FEC or the NSC or all the other alphabet soup agencies. They're vested in the legislature, which alone has the authority to make the trade-offs of legislative judgments. So, yes, we have a beautiful Constitution. The way we can love it more is to get back to what it actually says. Thanks.
Before I loose the panelists upon each other, I want to take the chair's privilege to throw one more issue into the mix. I note in the questions I'm receiving, both by the old technique and the new one, that there are a series of questions coalescing in two places. One is on structure of Congress and structure of the electoral college. The other is there is some attention to substantive issues like First Amendment rights and Citizens United. What I'd like to throw into the mix is this. All of us know it is almost impossible from a radical point of view to get an amendment ratified. It takes 3/4 of the states. That's very hard to do without an immense national consensus such as that over the 18-year-old vote during the Vietnam War. So I think the panelists need to think, and we all need to think, about whether some amendment we want to do is doable, or whether it's just fodder for professors and Conference of World Affairs. Listen. With that in mind, here's one thing I've seen over the past years, and that is, how about a single amendment? What it does is change the ratification process from 3/4 of the states to make your number. Some of you know state constitutions which have very low thresholds for amendments. The Colorado Constitution will be on your ballot always, every election we have. State constitutions run on a long ways very often. So there are obvious downsides to it, but there's a question, what about a process amendment that just makes it easier for we the people to change this thing or that thing or the other thing? That said, I'll turn all of you loose on each other's ideas. Anybody want to start?
I'll respond to what you just said, which is that I would resist any reform that continues to use the primary political unit in the United States as the state. And part of that is because of the problem I described in my opening remarks, that 50% of the country is going to live in 8 states. And so if you set the threshold for an amendment to 2/3, you can set it to just half, and there's still going to be a colossal unfairness there, because half the country is not going to be anywhere near whatever threshold you're proposing. I think it's useful to know why our nation is organized with the state as a political unit, and it goes to the issue of why we refer to these things as states and not as provinces or prefectures or some other term that other nations use for their political subdivisions. So the reason why is because after the Revolution, we were not a single country. The 13 colonies became 13 independent sovereign nations. And the Articles of Confederation, a confederacy was not a form of a nation. A confederacy was a form of alliance. And so it was an alliance amongst 13 independent nations that agreed to give up some power collectively. And they did that for a singular purpose, which was that the Founding Fathers were very aware of the history of Europe. And they were aware that in a continent where you have multiple small independent nations, they tend to go to war with each other a whole lot. And so they wanted to have a way to bind together these 13 independent nations in a way that wouldn't cause them to go to war in the way that England was always at war with France. The Articles of Federation didn't work out for them, and so when they drafted the Constitution, they continued to think of the state as the fundamental unit, because at the time, the Constitutional Convention wasn't a conversation amongst 13 political subdivisions of a sovereign nation. It was a conversation amongst 13 different nations. And that meant they had more leverage. It meant, and this, by the way, actually happened, Delaware could demand something like the unequal suffrage that we had in the Senate and threaten to form an alliance with Britain, whereby it would go to war with the other states if it didn't get what it wanted. And so the structures that we have now, this idea that we will be formed around states, was built around this concept that, first of all, states should be thought of as independent nations with independent identity, and second of all, that they might go to war with one another. Now, I haven't spent that much time here in Boulder, but I have a high level of confidence that Colorado is not going to go to war with Utah. The premise that we base our constitutional structure on no longer exists. We now have a national identity. And I'll say one other thing, which is that the statehood admissions process has been manipulated many, many times throughout history. Through much of the 1800s, there was a rule where every time you admitted a free state, you had to admit a slave state, because otherwise the slave states would freak out because they lose equal suffrage in the Senate and they couldn't block bills that could have restricted slavery. In the Lincoln administration, they admitted Nevada as a state, even though Nevada only had 40,000 people, and it was nowhere near the threshold the population threshold that applied at the time for the admission of new states, because Nevada was a Republican territory, and Lincoln was afraid of losing his majority in the Senate in the midst of a civil war. The admission of Nevada wound up mattering a great deal in 1888, because in 1888 it meant that Republicans had a two-vote majority in the Senate, and they were able to use that leverage that two-vote majority gave them to admit Dakota, not as one state, but as two states. The reason why there are two Dakotas is because the Republican Party wanted four senators instead of two. So this is a process that has been manipulated throughout our history. It's based on an assumption that no longer exists. Again, like New Hampshire isn't going to war with Vermont. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And so if we're going to think about the Constitution that we want, we should think in terms of the nation we have. We should think in terms of a nation that has a coherent national identity. And we should think about a nation that accepts the premise, with some exceptions, that we should have a one-person, one-vote rule. That it is immoral to say that a person in California, which has 68 times as many people as the state of Wyoming, should have 1/68th of the representation in the Senate.
I wouldn't want to go down to the Red River between Texas and Oklahoma on any Oklahoma, Texas, OU weekend and say there's no possibility of those states going to war if they don't have some of the constraints of the federal constitution in place. The second thing is, and I think this is important, and I'll go back to Washington, the notion that most of the sovereign powers, as originally conceived, were reserved to the states or the people, not to the federal government, was designed to prevent the federal government from becoming omnipotent. Because when you get that much power consolidated in one place, it's gonna, history tells us, tend to be abused. This diffusion of power, subsidiarity, if you will, that comes from the constitutional structure of federalism, is designed to prevent that kind of accumulation of power in the central government. One of the reasons we have been so successful is because we have that diffusion of power. You want to consolidate all this to a single national legislature, you end up with a single plebiscite. You consolidate all power in one place, it's going to be abused. The prospect of despotism that flows from that, history tells us, is nearly 100%. The reason we've been so successful in avoiding that is because of the diffusion of power. The vertical diffusion of power, federal to the states, as originally conceived, and the horizontal diffusion of power between the separate branches of government. And then in the most powerful of those three branches, the legislative power, they said, was the most powerful. It had the power of the purse. They separate that further to prevent majority tyranny. Because if you get majority tyranny, the minority's rights are worthless because the majority can have at it whatever they want. So the reason we have the Senate is not to protect the slave interests. In fact, you know, the whole the council, all of it, they were designed to restrict the slave power. The reason we have the Senate is a principal check on majority tyranny. Now, maybe human nature has gotten better than it was back then. We don't have to worry about that. I suspect not. And I think the reason we have succeeded as phenomenally well as we have is because these structural limitations on the power of the central government to aggrandize its power to the detriment of all of our liberty.
I want to express appreciation to Mr. Eastman for his candor in listing the sorts of things that are on the table, basically, with this Supreme Court, even though we disagree substantively about the analysis of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. If you can look through that list, it's having a Federal Election Commission. It's having an EPA. It's having an energy department. It's having the power of these agencies through the federal rulemaking process to issue rules where people have an opportunity to comment on those rules. When you think about it,
Civil Rights Act.
Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the ability to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Everything is really at stake if you're going to roll the clock back, 90 years. And I would say to you, I think there are a couple other pieces of that. One is, and this is not to ignore your question about, could we have a structural change? You know, I'm open to considering options for how we deal with the reality that we face, which is, in fact, I think, minority tyranny of the minority. There's this fear of tyranny by the majority. That's not actually what we're facing. That's not the reality. The reality is that we, as Ian pointed out so eloquently, we have this real minority rule happening in a lot of different ways in our country. It's not just the Senate as it was constructed. It's beyond that in terms of electoral college and more. But when you think about this idea of, you know, harkening back to Washington's farewell address, which I heard many times when I was working on the Senate Judiciary Committee, it's a tradition to read it. One of the things that strikes me is this obsession with debt, which the Constitution expressly provides for Congress to have the ability to incur debt. I'm not suggesting it should incur it willy-nilly, and I'm sure people think that it has. But the fact is, you can look at the Republican and Democratic record on debt and see the way the rhetoric waxes and wanes depending on whether the Republicans are in power or not, whether they give a damn about whether there's any debt or not. But to the extent that you want to embrace President Washington's idea that we've got to preserve for posterity, you know, we've got to deal with debt for posterity, these same voices that hearken to the problems of debt are doing nothing to address the real problem we face in the 21st century, which is climate change. And this effort, by this Supreme Court, by these five justices, is, I think, aimed in part at taking away our power as a people, acting through the federal government, our nation, that deals vis-a-vis other nations with global problems, take away our power to redress climate change, to mitigate the devastating climate changes that are underway, to have an EPA that can even regulate carbon at all. We're at a critical moment in our history, in human history on this planet, in terms of our ability to take any action to mitigate the dangerous processes that are underway, that are, without a doubt, despite the skeptics funded in part by the fossil fuel industry, without a doubt, human-caused. We have very little time to redress this in these next 10, 20 years. We have a Supreme Court that's captured by this archaic view that they have the power by judicial fiat to roll back the clock that far. They're going to take away our power to deal with the fundamental crisis we face and that our future generations face. And I don't think that the Constitution, in the words of another famous justice, is a suicide pact.
Step back from all these hot issues a little bit and just ask, make the observation that Americans really, in general, pride themselves on thinking they love the Constitution. And one of the questions I was trying to raise is that true? And I think one of the things that you can gather from some of the impassioned comments, shall we say, from my left, is that at least very significant part of the political forces today do not love the Constitution. They hate it. They find it as an impediment. We just heard a very intelligent and forthright exposition of why federalism, one of the two basic structural principles in our Constitution, is completely outdated and nefarious. Now, that may not count as hatred, but it's not exactly love either. Let me just make one or two other observations along the same line. Along with our love of the Constitution, we love the Supreme Court. Everybody hates the decisions that they don't like, but they love the court as an institution. They keep wanting, pining away for some sense of stability and confidence that comes from having the rule of law and a Supreme Court that represents the rule of law. But I think that both sides of this political spectrum over the last, certainly since the beginning of the 20th century at least, and maybe before that, have viewed the Supreme Court as a way of achieving their political objectives. And they clothe it in terms of the rule of law. They convince themselves it's the rule of law. But what it is, for the most part, what it has been, is a powerful urge to dominate that court so that we can dominate the country through what are essentially legislative acts on the bench. That's not compatible with the original tripartite system of government that's set up, just like our hatred of federalism on the part of many today is matched by our underlying hostility to a limited and strictly legal role for the Supreme Court. And the horrible political fights that we see over appointments to the Supreme Court, whether it's Republicans doing it or Democrats doing it, it's a sign that we don't love the rule of law, we do not love the Constitution, we want to distort it and exercise power through the courts. And finally, again, this is a big topic, but if you think that we're serious when we as Americans say we love the Constitution and that it's fundamentally sort of secure and we can tinker around the edges and preserve the essence of it, you might also not just think about the way we use the judiciary and the hatred in many quarters for federalism, but think about the changing attitudes on the most fundamental of our Bill of Rights, freedom of speech. This is a big topic. I can only suggest that current trends, and they're deeply entrenched, they're very powerful trends that have swept through the university system and through much of our political institutions. Think of the general acceptance, and I mean this seriously, the general acceptance of the proposition that the government can suppress anything that it decides is hate speech. That's a very popular, widely accepted view that is almost certainly completely incompatible with any serious notion of freedom of speech. Yet we go on saying we love freedom of speech, we love the Constitution, we love the courts. I don't know. I'm very skeptical about it, and I think some of the comments that we're hearing on this panel show really, not that this makes it bad, but it is revealing to see how much hostility we in fact have to our Constitution and have had for a long, long time.
Let's have one rejoinder, and then we're going to bring in some of the audience questions.
Sure. I just feel obligated to respond to the idea that I hate the Constitution. I think, again, when we're talking about rhetoric, no matter how soberly it's stated, I think that that's certainly inconsistent with the point of view that I've expressed. I think there are many things that are great about our Constitution. I think that there are ways in which it's flawed and that it should be remedied. And I don't think that's out of hatred. That's out of love for our nation and for the ideals that are embodied in our Constitution, the values that the people who not just framed the Constitution, but the people who ratified those amendments, who insisted on those amendments, believed in, values that embody freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. So I think that there are a lot of important components of our Constitution, but I don't think that it can exist if it's brittle and frozen in time in a way that basically makes it impossible for us as a people to address the challenges we face as a people. And I also think, I appreciate the fact that there was an admission that there's hostility, if you want to talk about hostility, to the idea of direct election of senators. 2 years ago, in an organization that I've been tracking for many years, the American Legislative Exchange Council, I was shocked and stunned to see them embrace this idea of repealing the direct election of senators. The reason they want to repeal that is because through gerrymandering, through the red map operation in 2010, and what it has brought forth in this past decade, they believe that they can't gerrymander the Senate in terms of trying to figure out how to prevent a Democrat from becoming elected to a Senate, even with the disproportionate things that are happening in the Senate. They want to put that in the hands of those legislatures that are gerrymandered through things like red map. And so, you know, that again is this embrace of minority rule. And I think when you see the Supreme Court and where it's headed, what you see is judicial fiat, people being chosen not because they're going to follow precedent, but people being handpicked by someone who's not elected, put on a slate for a president to choose from, someone who makes no disclosures of his income, his revenue, his relationships with all these special interest groups and billionaires, choosing people, handpicking people, not because they're going to follow the law and follow the precedents that have served our nation well for decades, but with a desire and a hope, a yearning that they will overturn those precedents and return us back to these glory days of the Lochner era before the New Deal. And I think that that's a conversation we should be having as a country about whether that hidden agenda is one that we, the people, embrace, because I don't think people want to go back a century.
On the one hand, we love the Constitution. On the other, we won't comply with Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 that says the legislative power vested in Congress. We want the EPA to handle all of the global warming problem for us because we can't get the bills through Congress we want. We don't want these various other protections, the structural protections, because it somehow thwarts the will of the people when we're not actually exercising that authority through the constitutional structures that we have. The reason the legislature hasn't taken on some of the more aggressive remedies to global warming is there's a large majority of people that don't think the remedies are going to work. They're going to be immensely costly. They're going to cost us a lot of liberty as well as finances, and they're not going to solve the problem. And so the legislative policy, the people that actually have the authority under our Constitution to deal with these things, have passed. So we're gonna enhance the voice of the people by handing off that judgment to an unelected bureaucrat in the EPA? How do you love the Constitution's separation of powers basic structure and say we're going to ignore the core separation of powers? And just say, well, we want this policy. Now, when you've got an executive, and you both now twice mentioned that the president was not elected. Well,
right.
Where's the Constitution on that? He was elected under the Constitution. So how do you say you love the Constitution and then perpetuate this myth that he wasn't elected when he was in fact elected by the structures set out in the Constitution? So what you want to do is throw over the parts of the Constitution you don't like, not do it by the amendment process, but by doing some judicial fiat. I don't see how that exacerbates that evinces the will of the people when we're going to thwart the will of the people as embodied in the higher law of the Constitution.
So,
this is preposterous.
So I'm a resident. I'm a resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Virginia. And if I had run for any office 60 years ago in the Commonwealth of Virginia, I would have been unelectable. And the reason I would have been unelectable is because I'm a racial liberal. I believe that black people and white people share the same humanity and should enjoy the same rights under the law. But if we had followed the rules as they existed 60 years ago in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the people who were most likely to support that agenda I just described, they weren't allowed to vote. So you can say, yeah, the rules are X, and John, I disagree with you a great deal about what our Constitution actually says. But let's set that aside.
Take the text.
I disagree with you a lot about what the text actually says. But let's set that disagreement aside.
That's easy to fix.
And having set that disagreement aside, I reject the proposition that because the current rules say X, that the rules A are just, and B that they must be maintained. Again, we are barreling towards a world where 84% of the representation in the Senate will be held by half of the nation, and 16% will be held by the other half. And whatever airy-fairy ideas you have about what George Washington thought about federalism, that's still unjust.
The chair declares constitutional law to become a visibly boring subject.
I want to know what text. I mean, I cited the text.
John, please.
He says the text is, he disagrees with my reading of the text. Maybe you've got a different version than I do. But I read it exactly.
John, let's move on.
Yes, please. We've heard passion on both sides of the aisle. I do want to bring in a couple of the questions that are predominated from the floor here. The first one, easily the most repeated, is known to all of us, and that is, what do you think of the National Popular Vote Pact that Colorado just joined? This is part of a larger issue of statutory workarounds to the difficulty of amending the Constitution. For example, a related one that came up that bears on what's been said is, do you think Supreme Court terms should be changed by statute to 18 years to get rotation on the court, et cetera, to reduce the number of term confirmations? So what I'd like the panel next to talk to the audience about is, what do you think of the National Vote Pact, including as an example of statutory efforts to ease some current polarization?
I think the National Popular Vote Compact is a really interesting idea. So the idea is that the Constitution doesn't actually tell states how they have to assign electors. You don't have to hold an election. The state legislature could, if it wanted, just say, like, here's who the electors are, and they can vote for whoever they want. And so the theory is you get a block of states that have 270 electoral votes to say that we will give our electors whoever wins the national popular vote. So it's a way to get rid of the Electoral College without having to go through the impossible process of amending the Constitution. I think it's a really good idea. I think it's a really interesting idea. I also really worry about it, and here's why. If, like, 10 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, something like this had come down, I think it could have been implemented fairly, and I think it would be fine. But the Supreme Court we have now is very partisan, and we live in a post-Bush v. Gore world. And what worries me about the National Popular Vote Compact is that while I'm not convinced by any of the arguments against its constitutionality, I think that five members of this Supreme Court are likely to be selectively convinced by them if being selectively convinced by them would elect a Republican president. And so my concern is that while I think it's a good idea, it's ultimately something that the Supreme Court has the power to strike down, and they would likely use that power selectively, depending on who would benefit from it.
Yeah, It's happening unconstitutional. Look, the language that they're basing it on says that the states get to choose how to pick their electors. Right? Now, the theory behind it is we can have somebody outside the state pick our electors for us. That's the theory of the National Popular Vote Compact. That we enter into a compact to let the folks from Vermont and Arkansas and Texas and the popular vote gained by there cast our electoral votes, even if the people of this state disagree with that resolution. You might as well say the Sultan of Brunei can be the one to cast our popular vote. To read the language of the Constitution's permission of the states to choose how their electors are chosen, to be so broadly as we can delegate that power beyond the confines of our state jurisdiction.
If you point me to the language in the text of the Constitution, which establishes the principle that states cannot take into consideration the views of anyone outside their borders.
Yeah, it's the language says the states can pick, choose how they choose their electors. The notion of that means we can assign the power to choose our electors to somebody that has no connection with our state whatsoever.
Right, can you point to the language in the Constitution that establishes that specific proposition?
Yeah, just like Article 1, Section 1 that you were ignoring earlier. I began by saying the language is broad and says the state can choose the electors. But to read into that, that they can delegate that power to somebody beyond the states, is to so fundamentally undermine the principle of consent of the government in the state.
Okay, so
that's not to be compatible with the theory behind that language.
Right, I think we can see the issues.
I will say this, that the language, if you interpret it literally, as you, Ian, wants to do, would permit a state legislature to permit all the, shall we say, just as an example, all the Democrats in the state to vote for electors, but not Republicans. It would permit them to decide, well, we'll let white people vote for the electors, but not black people. It doesn't take specific textual language to tell you, just as a matter of wild prediction, that the Supreme Court, in a heartbeat, would say that's unconstitutional. The power of the state legislatures, despite the text, does not go that far. And so the question becomes, as John, I think, correctly said, is it similarly unconstitutional by some independent principle for the state legislature to say, we are going to disenfranchise the people in our state who vote for electors and disagree with the judgment of a national majority? Is disagreement with a national majority legitimate grounds for disenfranchising their vote? Well, it's not exactly the same thing as disenfranchising black votes, but it's pretty darn close.
I want to see if Lisa has something quick to add to this. Then I want to add an issue that will undoubtedly wind us up.
I do want to read to you Article 1, Section 1, which does say that all legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. But it does not forbid Congress to create agencies that are empowered then to help implement the laws of Congress. And I think that this sort of debate is worth having, but I think this sort of adamant notion that therefore we've got to roll back the clock 70 years and 80 years and everything that's happened in the last several years is wrong and what the Supreme Court is about to do is legitimate. It's just, I think, an inaccurate argument. But I would say, and I'm going to open the little hornet's nest, and I promise to be short, which is to say, I think that people lament these judicial nomination battles and wars. Well, choose someone who has a consensus, someone who people on both sides of the aisle would respect, someone who has a record of a judicial record that is respected by people from all backgrounds, like Merrick Garland. But instead, what we see is a situation where people are chosen because of their extreme position, and they're jammed through to the Supreme Court for lifetime positions with the hope and intention that they're going to radically change our laws, as we've seen with Kavanaugh. And I would say one last thing on that, and then I promise I will step back, which is, I stand by every single word I said about Brett Kavanaugh being a liar, someone who lied to Congress repeatedly about his, in answer to questions, both written and oral, about his behavior, and I think he should never have been confirmed. And I think it's important for the people to have an opportunity through the Senate to stop someone if they are unfit, if they have a record of lying, of deceit, and deception, as Brett Kavanaugh had. And I think that's part of, you know, it's messy, and you may not like it, but I don't think we should have someone who has violated the judicial oath of office on our Supreme Court, and I think he should have been stopped, and it was righteous and rightful to try to stop him.
I hereby invoke the privilege of the chair to ask the last question. It comes from somebody who must have understood what was going to be said here during the length of our session. The question came down to, how can we look at the Constitution, interpret it, maybe change it, in ways that might reduce the extreme polarization that now attends our politics, our constitutional talk? Can we have the Constitution help us out here, was the question. I'd like you to leave the room thinking about that. Can any of us say anything that will advance that dialogue?
I'm going to forego going last just to say, I think that in this matter, as in other matters in terms of our politics, that it's important to understand that people love our country, and we may disagree. People have loved the idea of having the rule of law, what that means for our nation, which is not to be the law of just men or a king or a person who just dictates emergencies on the whim from the toilet or something on a Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning. I know that's bad of me. I failed. I was going so well. But I think it's important to understand that these are important debates, and they're sometimes heated debates, but they are debates that in a democracy we need to have about where we are, where things stand, and where we're headed. And I don't think that it does us, it helps us to suggest that people disagree with us hate America or hate our Constitution. I don't think that's right. I think people have great love for this country and for its values and for its aspirations and want us to be better to fulfill those ideals.
I agree with that. You know, calling Brett Kavanaugh a liar and Neil Gorsuch from Colorado here an extremist doesn't advance the ball. Both of those have demonstrated in their careers a faithful commitment to the text of the Constitution as written, not to precedent that ignored the text of the Constitution. And it's an interesting question. If you're a Supreme Court justice and you've got a body of precedent that blatantly ignored the structural limitations on federal power in the Constitution, which is the more faithful devotion to your oath to uphold the Constitution? To continue to adhere to a precedent that ignored it, or to attempt to recover the original meaning of the Constitution and the limitations on powers that are contained in it? The Constitution is higher law in this country because it was adopted by the ultimate sovereign, not by the legislature or not by unelected bureaucrats in the EPA, but by the people of the United States sitting in conventions. That's the higher law. We have the ability to change it. And to respond to something you said a little bit ago, it's impossible to change. I would suggest that the Supreme Court hadn't changed it on its own. The pressures for the American people to amend the Constitution to accomplish some of the things that maybe they wanted to do in the New Deal would have been great, and we might well have gotten some of those amendments. Instead of living on judicial fiat to change the Constitution without any actual input by the people. And that deprives the Constitution of its higher authority. It also deprives the court of its legitimacy. Why would we, in any stretch of the imagination, give to 9 unelected judges the power to settle every political question for us? In a democracy where we want to have the consent of the governed be the final say, why would we do that? And yet that's the system we've had over the last 75 years. So it's the notion that some justices who take seriously the limitations on both their power and on the legislative branch power that are contained in that Constitution are somehow Neanderthals seems to get it backwards. And if we're ever going to get back to the point where we can civilly discuss these things, we ought to take as the premise that the law says what it means and it can't just be changed if I can manage to get 5 votes on the Supreme Court. That's not any system we would choose ex ante, and we ought not to tolerate it ex post either.
Thank you, John. Thank you. we are out of time. I don't think this conversation is going to end, although that's the last you'll hear from us.